Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I am joined today by Emma Powell, news editor. How are you doing, Emma?
Yeah, very well, thanks.
Good. And Harriet Crawford, how are you, Harriet?
I'm fine, thank you.
Excellent. So, Harriet, you've written the cover feature this week.
I have, yes.
Sink or Swim
with
Shares.
With Megan Boxall, yeah.
With Megan, of course, who is not here today. But Sink or Swim Shares. I wrote a feature like this myself a few years back, and most of them sank.
Oh, well, let's hope that's not the case for all of ours.
No, I think you put a bit more analysis into it than I did at that point. Okay. And Emma, we're going to talk about the banks, because obviously the big news this week for the banking sector is RBS.
Yeah.
And the return to private ownership. Let's start with the banks. What's going on?
Well, like you said, obviously RBS second share placing this week by the government.
It's been a while since the first one, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it was 2015. August 2015, yeah. You can understand why, though, because the shares have been languishing. It's such a low value. It's a bit of a political hot potato, isn't it? Because obviously, and what's grabbed the headlines around this share sale has been that they booked, I think it was a £2.1 billion loss.
Yeah, yeah. But they waited a long time for the share price to bounce back, and it hasn't.
It hasn't. I mean, actually, having said that, it is still up this year, and it had quite a strong run last year, but it's just taking so long. You know, over the past decade, it's had so many problems that have continually just knocked it back.
Your piece suggests that those problems are kind of largely behind it. So I guess if you're talking about the politics of it, if the problems have all been resolved, why sell now when the shares are depressed?
Philip Hammond did budget in the autumn statement for £3 billion annually. I would say the reason they are going to sell now, firstly, like I said, the share price has actually recovered, even though, if you look back historically, it's still pretty weak. It has recovered a bit in the past 2 years.
So the buying price when the government bailed out the banks was £5, wasn't it? Near enough.
It was about £5. I think it was five hundred and one pence, something like that.
And the first sale, which happened in 2015, was
something like that. It was a much smaller discount. So I think it was this share sale, there was a discount of around 3.5%, and during August 2015 there was a discount of 2.3%, so it was a much smaller discount, much smaller loss. Which doesn't look great, but I think the major reason they've decided to sell now is because this DOJ settlement. You know, RBS has been all about the known unknowns, as they call them. So the fact they've had lots of ongoing litigation, lots of restructuring, had to take a lot of provisions. You know, they settled with the Department of Justice over the mis-selling of mortgage-backed securities prior to the financial crisis. They've taken that provision now. Their capital levels, even after taking that provision, are enough that people think they're going to return to dividends. So that was the removal of the last major obstacle. And I'd say if they can afford to be paying dividends to shareholders, then I'd imagine that's the rationale for let's now try and sell it back into private hands. And, you know, it's the return to normal.
What we do know is that apparently this placing was heavily oversubscribed, but it completed very, very quickly. So the institutional investors who were invited into this transaction seem convinced that RBS is about to recover. Do we agree?
It's really difficult because the thing is, I would say we've got it on hold, and that's not because its prospects aren't improving. It is. Its capital levels are superior to some of its peers, like Barclays.
Okay.
Which is, I guess, you know, yours group, kind of RBS, Barclays, Lloyds together. Lloyds is, I think, the top of all of them.
The less damaged.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and hence why it returned to dividends a while ago. But at the same time, its shares, because they have recovered quite a lot in the past 2 years, is actually trading at a premium to Barclays and only a slight discount to Lloyds. So I would argue that actually a lot of that improvement has been priced into the shares. It's very difficult to say. You know, I think it's just shy of its forecast net tangible assets, the shares trading at the moment. And Lloyds is like 1.1. And considering how superior Lloyd's return on equity is, and the fact it's been paying a dividend for the past, I think it's, is it 2 years, almost 3 years now, I don't see how you can justify buying into RBS. I just think it's...
I kind of agree, and it's what I've said in my editorial. I kind of look at RBS, and yeah, you talked about the known unknowns, or, you know, which was redress. But I worry about the unknown unknowns, and that's what's happening to the banking sector. And I guess a really good example of that is something that you've mentioned in your 7 Days piece this week, which is TSB, that in terms of technology, these big legacy banks are really struggling.
Well, that's the thing, that there is... You can tell there's a lot of nervousness around newer entrants coming in. I actually wrote a piece about the rise of digital banking and all these Monzos. And I mean, there's tons of challenger banks out there, not non-listed. And I think there is, I think the big banks are keeping one eye on all these newer entrants, which are gaining so many new customers.
It's really interesting. I mean, funny enough, my first job was in an advertising agency specializing in technology. The chief exec of that advertising agency has set up a bank, and it's a digital bank. I think it's called You or something. And basically, yeah, they're targeting people who can't get bank accounts from these guys. Or, you know, it's just the whole ground, and they're gaining customers apace. It's the whole ground of banking seems to be shaking up. And, you know, you've got things like open banking coming in, which you wrote about, Harriet, didn't you?
Yeah, in the regulation feature.
Yeah. So, the whole world of, you know, the foundation upon which these large banks have been built, including the legacy technology infrastructure they have, seems to be being pulled from underneath them.
Yeah, it is a major challenge. And like you mentioned, I mean, the risks of what can go wrong when you are updating your systems is evident in what happened with TSB. And obviously, they're under formal investigation.
But they're not the first, are they? I mean,
No. I mean, it makes perfect sense. There's so many risks. We're dealing with this large amounts of customer data for things to go wrong. But the only thing I would say about the big banks is they do have, they benefit massively from inertia still in terms of people switching.
In terms of private accounts, I mean, I say, you know, personal accounts rather than, say, business accounts.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the landscape is shifting more in the kind of provision of finance to small businesses, for example, than in the personal account space.
Oh yeah, things like that. I mean, that's partly why, you know, a lot of UK listed challenger banks like your Paragons and people like that have done so well, because in the wake of the financial crisis, and even now, to be honest, they just provide areas of finance which all the big banks retreated from.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's extraordinary. You know, buy-to-let being one of them, for example.
Buy-to-let, asset finance, even motor finance.
I mean, asset finance is huge. I was looking at some numbers from the British Business Bank. And yeah, asset finance is growing.
Yeah, it's massive.
Extraordinarily.
Pretty much all the UK-listed challenger banks have asset finance, probably after buy-to-let lending is the biggest share of their lending.
So I guess the big question for me, And again, the big question for our readers is, I mean, what is the attraction of a bank? I mean, in terms of an RBS or a Lloyd's or a Barclays, I put HSBC in a slightly different category.
That's an income stock.
But also much more international than the banks we're talking about. But I look at these banks and I think, why would I invest in them?
Yeah, I mean, historically, they were seen, obviously, as these, you know, great income stocks. I think this is twofold. So you can either get into a bank, I would argue, like Barclays, which is still, I think it's about 0.7 times forecast net tangible assets that it's trading on at the moment. That's the cheapest in the sector, I'd argue, and it is recovering. So you can either get into that, and I think the shares do have growth potential. They also have reinstated their dividend. Or you do go down something like a Lloyd's, which has a fair dividend yield. So I think it's twofold. But I think with RBS, the fact that, okay, it could reinstate its dividend, it's not good. For the next couple of years, I don't see the dividend yield or the dividend being as generous as like a Lloyd's or even actually like a Barclays. And I think the shares are, I think it's all the improvement is in the share price now. So I don't really see. And with the continuing share sales, like I said, it's about £3 billion annually expected to be over the next 5 years. That's going to continue to depress or, you know, hold down the share price. So I don't even see the growth prospects there.
I struggle to see the investment case for banks. What else have we got in the news this week? Some retail stuff. Harriet's not here this week. She's been hogging the podcast the past few weeks, but WH Smith, the worst shop in Britain.
Yes, worst shop in Britain, but done very well in terms of sales during the third quarter. So, in fact, actually, I think Harriet was saying they're up about a fifth over the year, which is rare for a retailer, because obviously the amount of bad news we've had. I think it's that where WH Smith's has benefited, despite being called the worst retailer.
Which it is. I mean if you've experienced a WH Smith store recently, which we all have, it's not a nice shopping experience.
Yeah, it's kind of confectionery and... Yeah,
overpriced confectionery.
Yeah.
We depend upon WH Smith's. It's important for us that WH Smith is a good retailer.
True, yeah.
But the results look all right, so...
Yeah, well, it's travel outlets. It's the travel outlets, which, you know, train stations, airports, that's what's driving the growth there.
Yeah, no, indeed. And the master of cost-cutting, of course, which we've talked about many, many times. Thank you, Emma. Let's move on to the cover feature, Sink or Swim.
Yep, and we've looked at a range of sink or swim possibilities in the feature. So I suppose, in a nutshell, what we've done with this cover feature is look at smaller companies listed on the AIM market, companies with a market cap between 40 and 250 million.
I think that's quite large.
It is quite
large. I think you've gone too high with that.
Well, small caps in a looser sense, I suppose. Originally, we were actually looking specifically at penny stocks, but so many companies looked interesting that were a tiny bit bigger that we sort of expanded our range a bit.
No, I jest.
Thanks. I think 40 million is also quite small, though. We didn't want to go any lower because that would sort of, they'd lose more their liquidity and all those sorts of things.
Absolutely.
But yeah, we specifically chose companies listed on AIM because AIM obviously traditionally is a high growth market for smaller companies, although it does now also accommodate massive giants like ASOS. And it also has less stringent listing criteria than the main market. So a few companies that wouldn't necessarily meet the criteria of a sort of main market IPO can sort of fit in there. So
And that's based on trading history?
Trading history, minimum market cap, minimum free float, so how much liquidity there's going to be. A lot of other criteria. But yeah, and what we wanted to do was look at companies that you wouldn't necessarily come across if you were going down a very traditional investment route in terms of the criteria you were looking at. So we've used counterintuitive screening criteria to look at those companies within that market cap range. One of the screening criteria we've looked at is zero revenues, which obviously threw up a lot of resources stocks, biotech companies, which Megan's looked at, but also some tech companies, along with some really weird and wacky sort of alternative energy, alternative broadband providers.
Doesn't sound enormously appealing.
Well, you know, obviously there is a heightened level of risk with these companies, and hopefully we've emphasised that within the feature. But I think if you look hard enough, as we've tried to do, there are some really interesting prospects out there. And yes, it could go either way with any of them. So hopefully it's a bit of an ideas generator.
So you've got the zero revenue companies.
Zero revenue companies.
And you've also got companies whose revenue growth projections are
very
eye-watering. And you look at them and think, really?
Yes, exactly. And what we've tried to do with each of these companies is, for example, look at companies with zero revenues and say, okay, well, what else has it got going for it? What are the factors that might make it sink, potentially? And what are the factors that might make it do incredibly well and actually start making revenues, hopefully, in the near future?
Swim,
exactly. And that's, we've chosen the sink or swim dichotomy because with these smaller companies, it really could be a case of complete failure if things go wrong because they are so small.
Yeah.
But so
let's start with the pre-revenue stuff. Perhaps pick out a couple of, I mean, Megan's not here, so let's not talk about the biotech stuff, which we
yeah, she's written about some interesting biotech things, but you can read those in the magazine.
You can. Let's talk about some of the non-biotech stuff.
Sure.
Where, yeah, there's an interesting opportunity. Maybe.
Yes. So we've actually spoken about EVR Holdings before on the podcast a few months ago, possibly in a more disbelieving way, but I'm actually a bit more confident about the company now. So EVR, in a nutshell, provides virtual reality music content. It sounds niche, it is.
we're going back to the gaming.
Preface it with that.
The esports thing now.
Yeah, exactly. But
really? People do that?
Apparently they do. And the reason that EVR has been pre-revenue until very recently is that its main flagship product, which is called Melody VR, had been in the testing stages for months. So the company IPO'd in 2016, and its shares, I think, at the time of writing the feature, were up over 1,000% since their IPO, basically on a concept and a theory alone, because their product hadn't launched commercially. What Melody VR does is allows you to watch the concert of your favourite band or singer from home using a VR headset or a VR-enabled smartphone.
Sounds brilliant. It's not why I go to concerts, but there you go.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. And I mean,
you like
looking
concerts,
at...
don't you, Emma?
Don't think I'd...
You wouldn't?
No, you're going to sit home with your VR headset rather than going to, you know...
What if...
No, I wouldn't.
What if you really wanted to get tickets for a concert and you just missed out and you found out you could watch the concert from home for £9.99?
You get to the pub, wouldn't you?
Probably, yeah.
Watch it on TV later.
I would, yeah. I'd watch it online.
Okay, later. Fair enough.
Sorry, I know I'm butting you here. I do get it.
Well, that's actually one of the sync factors that we've considered when looking at EVR holdings. We don't really know whether this idea is going to take off. You know, will Melody VR, I should say, the platform launched in the last few weeks. So EVR announced that they've finally launched their product in the US and the UK. So we're hoping for revenues, and the broker Investec has now published forecasts, which predict quite promising revenue streams.
Decent broker, actually.
Yeah, exactly. I think they changed brokers last year. But yeah, so that's encouraging. But we still don't know whether or not Melody VR is going to become very incredibly popular and achieve all the promise that the share price increase implied, or it's just not going to happen.
I do kind of get it. I mean, I was looking at, so my kids like Taylor Swift, of course, and
yeah.
Teenage girls.
I like Taylor Swift too.
Oh, do you now?
I do. I shouldn't admit to that.
And I looked at concert tickets. 90,000 people, Wembley Stadium, £100 a ticket.
Mm.
They're not going. But would they pay £20 to watch it on a VR headset? Yeah, maybe they would.
Yeah.
One problem I foresee with this is we don't actually have any VR headsets in the household.
Well, this is another point that we've kind of considered within the feature. So again, a potential sync factor, although it's not definitely a sync factor. EVR and companies like it, VR content producers, are really reliant on a buoyant VR headset market. So the headset producers at the moment, the big ones are Google, Facebook, Microsoft.
It's Oculus.
Oculus Go, yeah. is their hardware that EVR has launched with. VR is still kind of an unproven concept. You know, although it's taken years in the making, we don't know whether it's really going to become the next big entertainment form yet. It would be a bit of a disaster if a company like Google suddenly decided to withdraw their products, because then Melody VR has no platform on which to be used.
Mm.
So it needs the hardware to be there, and it needs people like you and your daughters to buy the hardware.
Oh, I'm not going to care.
But I suppose the idea is, as more and more companies like EVR produce high quality content, hardware developers will be more inclined to produce high quality headsets, and so that it's a very mutualistic relationship, and it's kind of out of EVR's control. But hopefully it'll work out for them.
I like the idea, and actually I do actually like the idea of virtual reality. I can see it taking off, but...
Me too.
This is a swim we're talking about.
It's a swim, yeah. And I should just add, I mean, one of the things that we've put into this part of the future is that actually management has quite significant stakes in EVR Holdings still.
Always good to see.
Exactly. The chief executive and the chief operating officer, I think, between them have about 23% of the shares. So that's encouraging. And yeah, we talk about lots of other swim points within the feature, but... you can read it.
Okay. Let's talk about a sync. Should we talk about a sync?
Sync, yes. So another zero revenues company that we've actually put as a sync is Blue Jay Mining. Just as a bit of background, Greenland's mining potential, the country Greenland, I should say, that its mining potential was only really recently discovered, thanks ironically to climate change. And Blue Jay, I mean, the one advantage of climate change.
The ice melted and they found a mine or something.
Well, they found this, it's the highest grade mineral sand ilmenite deposit.
Okay.
In the northwest of the country. And Blue Jay Mining is hoping to capitalise on this massive opportunity that's arisen via its Dundas project.
What is ilmenite?
Ilmenite is, I'm going to try and explain this properly, it's a titanium iron oxide mineral.
And what do we do with it?
It goes into titanium. It's a component of titanium.
Okay.
So it has various uses, including sort of industrial uses. And there is a big market for it. And it's exciting, I suppose, that this icy island has suddenly revealed a massive potential resource for it. But it hasn't yet been commercialised by Blue Jay Mining. As with all these companies, it's a very small company. It's shown incredible promise. Recently, it revealed a 400% increase in its resources on site in terms of ilmenite deposits. There's been a lot of communication from the company in the last year or so about how exciting this is and when it's hoping to bring the Ilmenite project into production in 2019.
Standard mining playbook.
Exactly. It's actually been interesting talking to Alex Newman, who obviously writes about mining, about it. And we sort of, we discussed it in detail together. And I think the bottom line for us is that if it were this easy to extract ilmenite from Greenland, it would have been done already by a larger company. It just seems, it obviously, it does sound like an exciting prospect. And I should say that Blue Jay also has other projects elsewhere. It has copper, zinc and nickel projects in Finland. So it is diversified across other metals markets.
Which presumably will give it the cash flows to try and exploit this wonderful deposit that it has in Greenland.
Exactly. And if this all works out and it does manage to commercialise its ilmenite project in Greenland, then it could potentially fund itself into larger metals markets. But I think it's too small a player in this potentially large market. And as I said, another company would have done it already if it were going to be this simple to do it, to take it into production this year or next year.
That's true, but they said that about the Falkland Islands and its oil. And that is happening, so...
Exactly. Again, I shouldn't say this, because we put it as a sink even, but with these things, it could surprise us. But I think for the time being, there seems to be...
We're cautious.
Too much bark and not enough bite at that point.
Bark or bite, sink or swim.
Bark or bite, yeah.
Let's talk about the other category of companies that you have in the feature, which are those companies with what we perhaps would look at in terms of the forecast revenue growth that analysts are placing on them and thinking that it might be a little bit overambitious.
Yeah. So we've looked at a few companies in the section, but... one of them was actually Seeing Machines, which I don't think we at the IC have actually written about before. It's grown massively in the last couple of years. So its market cap is just over 200 million now, I think.
This is a swim.
It's a swim. Swim. Yes. It's a swim, I should say, right now. So it's got a huge forecast compound annual revenue growth rate. Seeing Machines has a driver monitoring system, which essentially can go into cars or into aviation vehicles and detect whether the driver looks drowsy or distracted. And then it can alert the driver, tell them that they look drowsy or distracted.
Wake up, you nosy sod.
Well, hopefully not that. But, I think it sort of sends beeps to them. And then if they don't wake up, it can actually get the car to pull over or to slow down.
Okay.
And I think the World Health Organization says that 1.3 million people die every year in road accidents. And obviously that's not all caused by human error, but anything that can be done to improve driver safety... it's a good thing.
I can completely understand that.
I mean,
obviously, you look at London where we are now, and there's obviously lots of talk about knife crime epidemic.
Hmm.
But actually, one of the biggest killers of people in this country is the road.
The road, exactly. And I think for fleet, for sort of transport fleets, for planes, to me it seems this is almost limitless what it could get involved in. With the rise of autonomous vehicles as well, there's still going to be a human at the wheel, kind of, occasionally driving, you still need to have something monitoring them to check that they're with it and not asleep.
I think you're right. My view of autonomous driving is that actually people like driving, but what you want to have are systems that help them drive much more safely.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see how this is a good idea, a very good idea.
Yeah, and in terms of a couple of potential sink factors that we did consider, back in May, the company had to cut its sales guidance because its global manufacturing partner was facing shortages in certain components it needed for the system. So that was a little disappointing. But actually, only in the last few days, Seeing Machine shares were up massively, I think over 20%, if around 20%, because they announced a contract with a big US-based automotive original equipment manufacturer.
A car maker,
exactly.
Tesla, must be Tesla.
Well, they haven't said. It's anonymous. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But maybe that's what people were hoping. That's why the shares rose by so much. And they're actually hoping to take their driver monitoring technology into vehicles for mass production from 2020. So that's pretty exciting.
It could be huge then.
It could be huge.
Really huge.
Exactly. And I should also say the European Commission is thinking about proposals to mandate that new vehicle models have the kinds of safety features that Seeing Machines provides. So having that legislative push potentially as well could really drive growth in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. No, sounds really. Yeah. I kind of like this one.
Okay, good.
That's a wet one we don't like so much. You're chuckling there. We had a very long discussion about this yesterday.
We did with Mark Robinson as well, because Xeros is a buy tip.
The unsuccessful tips that Mark Robinson.
yes.
Sorry, Mark.
So Xeros, in a nutshell, develops plastic beads and other types of technology similar to that for the commercial laundry and tannery industries. That does sound very niche. But what they're trying to do is to reduce the amount of water that's used in commercial washing. So, for example, in sort of hotel washing rooms.
Yep. Get that.
And so these microbeads essentially should help to do that cleaning without using as much water. And obviously, water shortages have been in the news a lot recently. I mean, particularly, I think we were looking at, we were talking about Cape Town yesterday and the terrible water shortages they've had. Oh, I was. Maybe no one was listening. But you can imagine how, if this were adopted on a mass scale, it could have really positive implications. But
yeah, water shortages. It was a big thing. I mean, you used to cover utilities, didn't you, Emma? I mean, it was water. It's kind of like gold, isn't it? Really,
it is a finite resource.
It's a finite resource. So yeah, it makes sense. But
so I mean, just to think about a couple of the sink factors. Although I should say this is a swim within the future. So Xeros switched to a technology licensing model a couple of years ago. But after quite a few years of discussions about commercialising their product with manufacturers, they haven't quite done it yet. so they're still very much in the discussion phase with their manufacturing partners. And I think, as Mark wrote within his latest results on Xeros, I think the phrase he used was stuck in spin cycle, because a year ago when he covered them previously, they were still in those discussions with OEMs, with the manufacturing partners. So it does feel like it's taking an extremely long time to reach commercialisation.
The thing that struck me yesterday, and I must admit I hadn't thought of this before we started discussing it yesterday, was yes, water shortages are obviously a big thing, and you know, the preservation of water is very important. But a bigger thing that has come to kind of prominent political attention recently is plastic.
Yeah, plastic in the ocean.
And microbeads.
Yes.
And that's what they do.
I know. So it's a bit of a sort of conflict, I suppose, because on the one side, of course, you want to prevent water shortages and you want to improve clean water for people around the world. But at the same time, you don't want to be putting more plastic into the oceans. I think this is something that we'll need to ask Xeros about next time we speak to them.
I think so.
I mean, I would hope that their microbeads are being designed to be as environmentally friendly as possible.
Do the microbeads stay in the... Do they get washed out as well, then? Is that how it works?
Apparently they have developed some kind of filtration system to make sure they don't, but they...
But it's hard to know for sure. Particularly when we haven't seen it in a sort of commercial application. We don't really know quite how it works yet. But I think we're staying positive on the fact that...
Yes, I did you a bit of a disservice there. You are positive.
I'm positive.
It's not a sink, it's a swim.
It's a swim.
But I am not convinced by this one.
But I suppose that goes to show how controversial some of these stocks are. And, you know, it is a case of looking at it for yourself and thinking, do I really think this concept could work? It is, as with a lot of these, a real blue sky concept. But, you know, Berenberg, who's one of their brokers, says that their domestic laundry segment alone has an addressable market of over $1.7 billion, which is huge, if it manages to make its product successful.
I worry about that type of analysis. The market is this big.
Exactly.
We only have to take this much of it.
We have to be sceptical.
I really don't like that sort of analysis.
Yep. And actually... I don't know if this is appropriate for the podcast.
Yes, but, it is. Everything is appropriate for the podcast.
Jeffries said that it is squeaky bum time at the moment for
He wrote it in the feature.
It's in the feature.
If it's in the magazine, it can be on the podcast.
they accepted that it was, you know, a potentially difficult time for the company, but there are various ways for Xeros to deliver, as they're hoping. And, you know, there could be multiple contracts within its tanning segment as well. So it's not just laundry, it's also tannery that they do.
And this is turning... colouring leather, basically. Yeah. Interesting. Interesting.
So, yes. If it can reach its full potential, we think definitely worth buying into. But it's, as I said, very difficult to say. And you obviously disagree, which makes it even more interesting.
This is the whole point of these things. Yeah. They're Marmite stocks.
But, they are Marmite stocks.
I have to say, I mean, I've been wrong in the past about many things. Ocado is a great example of a company that many people, including me, thought, what the hell is this? And look what they've done recently.
I suppose
amazing, really.
The issue with Ocado is that a lot of people weren't quite sure how to value it, which sort of peer group to compare it to. Because is it a retailer or is it a tech platform?
I was never convinced that its tech platform would get the buy-in that it has. So, yeah. Just shows how easy it is to be wrong with these kind of companies.
Exactly.
And you've got So hang on, I can't count them. 14?
I 14 think companies about into, 14 companies.
You've gone into detail on.
Exactly.
But you've got a big table there for yeah. both categories. So lots of ideas here.
So yes, we have two big tables which give a list of pre-revenue stocks and also revenue stocks with ambitious revenue expectations. And we do obviously cover a few of those within the feature, but the list is long and there are other ideas in there.
Interesting thing on those tables is cash burn rates, which I think is a very important thing to look at when you're exactly. looking at these kind of companies.
Yeah, and we refer to the cash burn within quite a few of these in our actual write-ups, but hopefully the cash burn column should be helpful with the other companies too.
Absolutely. Thank you, Harriet. And thank you, Emma. Really interesting feature. Lots of good stuff in the news section. I think this banking question is a really interesting... You're writing an AFF report, aren't you, for us?
On banking, yeah.
Wow. Have you got started yet?
I have, actually, yeah.
Ooh. When can we expect that?
It is due at the end of June, I believe.
Okay.
So probably last week of June.
And what are we looking at? We're going to be looking at the big banks and the challenges.
Big banks, challenges, investment banking, which actually doesn't get that much coverage because a lot of the banks have obviously got rid of their investment banking operations. But there's a lot going on in terms of regulation in the US and also European banks. So.
Oh, God, European banks. Be careful with those. We're yep. a bit weird there. UniCredit.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Thank you, Emma. Right, plenty more in the magazine this week. As usual, reasonably busy results. Week this week, we've got John Barron's latest update on his investment trust portfolio. He's looking at technology, your area, Harriet. He's quite bullish on technology, actually, John.
Oh, well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
Depends which technology stocks.
Big tech. Big tech.
But US big tech.
US big tech. It's a bit interesting. He's a bit of a contrarian, but I think he's got a point here. I think these companies, they're world-changing type of companies, which we've kind of alluded to. Earlier, we're talking about Oculus, for example. All the usual personal finance and funds content, which they will be talking about on their podcast tomorrow. Lots of comment, as usual. Thank you for listening. Sink or swim. Small cap shares for the speculative investor. We will be back again next week. Thank you very much.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.